They put one over on them once, so they thought they were the shit and started betting on that Wednesday afternoon hockey game every week, well into the spring, each time for more money. Soon, like classic shitheads, they bet one-timer bets on every other game, but on those Wednesday games, they'd bet enormous fucking amounts. If they had any brains at all, they would have bet a steady number on those Wednesday games, and the guy never would have noticed. But they couldn't do that. They'd bet $200 a game when a 40-timer was a huge thing. It doesn't say much about Bobo's accounting department that it took them about 5 or 6 weeks to notice that these two Gavones were winning like 60-time parlays, which means that not only were they betting the team that won, they were also betting the over and under in the game, which is the point spread. A parlay means the two bets are connected, so unless you win both, you lose all the money. These are what we call long shots, and these guys hit 5 of them in a row, which is what we call astonishing and nearly impossible. So Bobo's crack team of bookies started to wonder what the hell was going on with these kids and if they knew somebody playing in the hockey game every Wednesday night. Bobo decided to do a little homework, so he picked up the paper and he realized that these two smartest kids from Jersey had been duping him for the last 2 or 3 months, betting on games that had already happened. Even though they were betting well above their means, we were all pretty small time, so they'd probably only taken him for about $800. Anyway, Bobo wasn't happy, and his middleman called our friend to deliver the message. "Listen, motherfucker," he said. "Your buddy's fucked up, and they won again this week. They are not getting that money, and Bobo wants the money they ripped him off for. Bobo is fucking livid. Your dumb fuck buddies are going to meet Bobo himself, not me, at that fucking McDonald's this week, you hear me? They don't show up, you're all fucking dead." "I got nothing to do with this," our friend said. "I didn't rip him off. Bobo don't fucking care, you hear me? You're all answering for this, asshole. Go to the back of the McDonald's, the booth on the left-hand side." "Okay," my friend said, pretty worried. "How am I going to know who he is?" "He's 50, bald with tattoos. Fucking be there." The guy hung up. My friend, the middleman, and my friends, the hockey bettors, were scared shitless. There was no way they were going to meet Bobo. My friend who got the call had to go, so I went with him, even though we weren't the assholes ripping him off. It didn't matter to Bobo. We were all getting punished that week. He didn't pay anything the rest of us had won, plus we were getting a talking to. My friend and I went down to the McDonald's at the usual time, went into the back, and saw a guy who matched the description. Our hearts were pounding as we walked over to him. He told us to sit down. He was sitting there with a quarter pounder with cheese and an order of large fries in front of him. "You want a fry, kid?" he asked me. "Yeah, sure," I said, and I took one. I thought that was very nice of him. We sat there in awkward silence as Bobo looked down in concentration, refusing to make eye contact with us for about 2 minutes. Then he looked up. "You two motherfuckers tell your fucking friends something from me," he said real low, leaning forward and staring us in the eye. "If they ever try something like this again, I will find out where they live, and I will fucking kill their parents. If they got kids, I will fucking kill their kids in front of them. I will make them fucking watch, and then I will tear their fucking hearts out." He started yelling real loud and got a bit red in the face. "I will rape their fucking grandmothers, you hear me? I am not here to be made a fucking fool of. I will hit them with a bat as hard as I can in their fucking face." My friend and I were kind of looking down out of respect for Bobo as he went on threatening to rape and kill people. But then both of us looked up at him, then at each other, and just started hysterically laughing. It was Ash Wednesday, and Bobo, being a good Catholic, was sitting there with an enormous ash cross on his forehead, threatening to murder our unborn children and behead our deceased relatives. He'd obviously gone to church, got his ashes, and didn't stop to think just how ridiculous he would look screaming at us with a cross on his forehead. We didn't know what to do, because there was no way we were going to stop laughing. We had that uncontrollable laughter that nerves and ludicrous situations bring on. All we could do was put our heads down and hope that Bobo would think we were trembling with fear instead of shaking in hysterics. But we were no longer looking at him, and he was getting really pissed. He started shouting louder and louder, and his face got redder and redder, which made that enormous black ash cross look even funnier. "You motherfuckers better show me some respect," he screamed. "You're not getting a fucking cent of the money I owe you this week. You tell those motherfuckers to get me my money, or I'll kill them and I'll kill their family. Now get the fuck out of here. Get out of my sight." We got up and made it to the door, but as soon as we were in the parking lot, we burst out laughing harder than we had before. We could barely move. We had to lie on the hood of my 1970 Chevy Nova for about an hour laughing. "I don't even think he knew it was there," my friend said. "His wife probably told him when he left this morning, 'Make sure you get ashes, Bobo. It's Ash Wednesday today,' I said. 'And bring home some soda bread.' I'm sure he was like, 'Okay, honey, I'll get the ashes. Then I have to go threaten to rape and kill a couple of kids' families over in Jersey. Then I'll pick up the bread.' See you tonight. And Bobo's Ash Wednesday cross was just enormous. It was as big as the cross that Jesus climbed up the fucking mountain with. That was the pinnacle of 1990, that year of shit for me. Then in February 1991, a friend told me that he put in a word for me with his father, since he knew the job in the machine shop with Goof was a dead end. All my friends knew that I'd tried stand-up again, but nothing much was happening with that, so I needed a good job. He told me that his dad had openings for longshoreman jobs down at Port Newark, and everyone who knows anything about that knows that those jobs aren't exactly advertised in the paper. You have to know somebody because they are positions coveted by any guy who has no college degree. If you get one, you're set. The union is so amazing that you're taken care of for life. My buddy's father was very respected in the union. He got Port Newark and Elizabeth running really well in his years in office. It was no longer the way it was in the old days of On the Waterfront with Brando and Johnny Friendly. Nobody ripped off anybody anymore, and the union insisted on honest, cooperative relationships with management. Somewhere along the line, they figured out that in the long run, it was better for their guys to keep the peace instead of stealing a piece of everything that came through there. Since my friend's dad was putting in a word for me, I was able to go down and start working part-time just by showing up and saying that he'd sent me. He had that kind of standing in the union. I'd be able to work my way up, and when a permanent position opened up, I'd be in there for life. At the time, the part-time rate was $19 an hour, and there was always a lot of overtime. You could get time and a half for a while, and then double time kicked in. There were guys down there who could not spell their fucking names who were making $100,000 a year with overtime. I got a position at the orange juice pier where ships came in from Brazil and unloaded liquid orange juice concentrate. When a ship came into the port, it took 3 hours to tie it up and hook up huge hoses through which 3 million gallons of orange juice concentrate would flow into refrigerated tanks. It took about 4 days for all of the orange juice to be pumped out, and according to union law, 4 longshoremen were required to be there the whole time to supervise the operation. For those 4 days, you slept there, and you were on the clock, being paid 24/7. To pass time, the tradition was that you played cards. I would play 500 rummy, and I tried to learn how to play pinochle with Chick, the old-time Italian longshoreman who enjoyed whipping my fucking ass. Chick was as good as a professional card player, and a prick about it, too. You'd play 500 rummy with this guy, and he would let you get up 400, almost 500, before he'd methodically take your heart out with his hands. He'd let you get, like, 10 points from victory, then beat you and leave you owing him money. Chick had also played speed chess, which was fine with me, because he really enjoyed kicking this management guy's ass all the time, and the rest of us really enjoyed watching it. This guy was an engineer who graduated from Yale, and Chick would take him for $200 a week. The guy kept coming back, thinking he was going to get one over on this old Italian guy, but he never did. It killed the guy that Chick, who probably barely made it to 7th grade, was beating him every single day on his lunch hour. Every day on the way to work, Chick listened to CBS FM in his Lincoln Continental as he made the 5-minute drive from the down next section of Newark where he lived to the port. He'd listen to the famous Harry Harrison in the Morning Show and absorb whatever oldies they were playing. Since Chick worked right next to me putting lids on the huge drums of orange juice concentrate, I'd hear him for the entire morning sing whatever song it was that he just heard in his car on CBS FM. If the song didn't interest him, or if he wanted to break it up a little, he'd do a jingle that he made up about Harry Harrison. He'd do all of this at the top of his lungs. For 4 hours, since he always added curses to whatever he sang, he would belt out things like this. Kathy's clown, Kathy's motherfucking clown. Hey Jude, hey fucking Judy, fucking Judy, fucking Judy, hey fucking Judy, cocksucking na na na, na na na, fucking Jude. But my favorites were the jingles. Harry Harrison, Harry fucking faggot Harrison, in the cocksucking morning. You had to find a way to enjoy it because no one was telling Chick to stop. He ran the place. Every morning, lunch trucks would come at around 10:30, loaded up with potatoes and egg sandwiches or peppers and egg sandwiches, and Chick would buy everybody a first break snack. You try to give him $5 for your sandwich, and he'd get truly offended, like close to violence offended. Get the fuck out of here with your $5, he'd shout at me. You think your piece of shit $5 is going to make me rich? Fucking eat the sandwich. Since I was a low guy on the totem pole, he'd usually ask me to go get the lunch. There was an Irish kid who worked with us who would order potato and egg sandwiches with ketchup on it, which is like sacrilegious to Italians. It's the same as putting cheese on linguine with clams. You just don't do it. I didn't feel good about it, but I ordered it for the guy anyway. The owner of the truck was this Italian guy, and when I put the order for ketchup, he stopped what he was doing and he looked at me like I just told him to go fuck his mother. I do not do ketchup, he said. Listen, I know it's not for me, I said. The guy's Irish who wants it. He doesn't know what the fuck he's doing. He asked for ketchup. Fuck him. I do not do ketchup. Man, come on, just give me a couple of ketchup packets. I got to bring everyone lunch. I will give you no ketchup, not on my sandwich. You are not going to ruin that fucking sandwich. Are you really going to make me go somewhere else for ketchup packets? No, he said, staring me down. I do not want to hear about you or anyone else putting fucking ketchup on my sandwiches. I will not enable you to do that. Fuck that. You get no ketchup from me. Every day I would have to go to the fucking diner down the street, buy a cup of coffee, and ask for ketchup packets. It took me an extra 20 minutes, all because this fucking Irish guy who had no idea how to properly eat an Italian potatoes and egg sandwich had to have ketchup on it. There was another character down there, unlike anyone I've ever met, who we'll call Tony D, who was always butting heads with the management people. He was an older guy who liked busting all the younger guys' chops about broads and whatever else came to mind. We were split up into two teams. I was part of the crew that loaded those huge 50-gallon drums with orange juice. The other crew loaded and unloaded trucks. Tony was on the truck side of the operation. Whenever our break ended, Tony would still be on our side of things talking shit. So one of the management guys, all of whom were these nerdy Ivy League types in white coats, would have to walk over to him and timidly say, Tony, you've got to get back to work on your side now. Tony D loved this. He waited for it, each and every break. He'd get right up in their face, half kidding and half serious, just to fuck with them. I'm breaking balls here. You're telling me I can't break balls, he'd say? That'll be the fucking day when I can't break balls. Fuck you! At this point, he'd turn away, too angry to go on. He'd actually turn toward us, give us a wink, leaving the management guy to kind of whimper away, looking like he's going to cry. I became close friends with a few of the guys I worked with down there, one of whom was a senior longshoreman. This guy was basically the foreman of the group and essentially my boss. One Friday night at the end of work, he asked me if I wanted to go fishing with him the next day. Now, I had never gone fishing and didn't really give a shit about learning how to fish, but he was a good guy, not to mention that he was my boss, and I wanted to get in good with him. I told him sure, and he said he'd pick me up at 5:30 the next morning. We'd launch his boat from Elizabeth, and we'd go fishing for bluefish and tuna. Like I said, fishing was just not the kind of thing I did, and having never done it before, I agreed to it without giving it much thought. With the same lack of thought, I then went to happy hour with the guys from work like I did every Friday and started to get ossified drunk. In those years, I really took Friday happy hour to heart. I would get so drunk that more than once I bet twice on the same game. I did it this night too. At 5:30, after a few drinks, I called my bookie to bet on a game. Then at 7:30, just before he stopped taking bets, I called him back and bet on the same game, but this time I bet on the opposite team. Now, the only thing that could possibly happen, given that the guy took both my bets, was that I would lose. I was basically giving him the vig. It would have made more sense for me to just call the guy and tell him I'd like to give him $50. I did it three separate times that year, all of them during Friday night happy hours, which should give you an idea how much drinking went on. Wait, what did I do? I asked him the next morning after that third time. You called me at 5:30 and bet on one team, then you called back at 7:30 and bet on the other team, the guy said matter-of-factly. Can I ask you why you let me do that? I said, annoyed. You know I forget shit when I'm drunk. You should have reminded me that I'd already placed a bet. I'm trying to teach you a lesson about drinking and gambling, he said. They don't mix. Wait a second. Am I getting a life lesson from a bookie? I feel like I'm at the end of an episode of Different Strokes. You gotta learn, man, he said. Only way to learn not to be a dumb fuck is the hard way. Listen, buddy, do me a favor. From now on, don't teach me life lessons. Just tell me I'm drunk and that I've already bet and then hang up on me. Drinking was definitely the thing after work on Fridays, mostly at a couple of bars right there in Newark. This place Zip Zip, or Tony DeCanica's, which had great Zuba Depeche. We lived pretty large all around. We got an hour and 15 minutes for lunch every day, which was another great union perk. And sometimes we'd go, all a mess in our work clothes, to these formal restaurants. There was a Spanish tavern, Iberia, and a few great Portuguese and Italian places. We would eat like kings, with waiters in tuxedos serving us. Then we'd go back to work at the port. My favorite lunch down there, though, was this amazing deli called Amelia's, run by this little old Sicilian lady. Amelia made a different special every day, and every once in a while she'd make a big vat of broccoli rabe, and the special would be a sandwich of broccoli rabe with fresh mozzarella on amazing bread from Napadano's, this great old bakery down the street. Then we'd walk across the street to Nasto's, this chocolate factory in the middle of Down Neck, Newark, and get this huge ice cream sundae. After a lunch like that, let me tell you, the last thing you'd want to do is fucking work, let alone put your tool belt on over your fucking gut. All you're really qualified to do after a lunch like that is sleep for 20 hours. There was another little home cooking place we liked too, called Cookies. It was run by a 350-pound Italian woman whose sons were part-time bookies who never worked. Cookie had turned the basement of her home into a little restaurant, probably to support them, and every morning she'd fry 200 meatballs and a bunch of green peppers in oil. When I first started working at the port, I didn't have a driver's license because I lost it after being busted on a DUI charge. So my foreman, the same senior longshoreman who invited me fishing, would drive me to work. Every morning we'd stop off at Cookies so he could put in a bet or pay off or collect from one of our sons, and soon enough, I started doing the same thing. We'd stop over there at like 7:30 in the morning, since we had to be at work by 8, and if we got to her place at the right time, she'd be coming out of the kitchen with 200 freshly fried meatballs and peppers, and she would say, "Help yourself." It smelled so good that I'd start grabbing meatballs with one hand and putting them on a plate while forking into the peppers with my other hand. I'd end up, for breakfast, eating about 10 of these things with 5 helpings of peppers, about 3 pieces of bread, and a soda or root beer to wash it all down. These were not some kind of gay turkey meatballs like you see these days, by the way. They were unbelievably beautiful, real meatballs made of beef and veal. It was the breakfast of champions, and the best way to warm up for my hour and 15-minute lunch. Anyway, the night before this fishing trip, I was out with all the guys and my foreman, and by 10 p.m. I was stone drunk off my ass. I'd done a little blow that night, too, since there was some going around, so I was nowhere close to getting a good night's sleep before the big adventure. That's not what I told the foreman, though. When he came up to me, slapped me on the shoulder, said goodbye, and told me he'd be over to pick me up bright and early at 5:30 a.m., I couldn't have been more enthusiastic. "Dude," I said, "I'll be ready. It's going to be great." All night long, I had talked up how much I was ready for it and looking forward to it, assuring him that I was really into fishing. I ended up going out to a go-go bar in Linden, New Jersey called Cheeks, with my friends Chico and Shecky and another one of the many Mikes. I did not get home until 3 or 3:30 a.m., and when I did, I was drunk, high, and covered in cheap lipstick from the many dancers I had paid to kiss me on the cheek. I passed the fuck out in all my clothes, and by the time 5:30 came around, I'd barely gotten a nap and was nowhere close to being sober. I was lying there like a Neanderthal, sweating like a pig, with puffy eyes, my hair all over my face, and my mouth wide open. The phone must have rung for a few minutes before it woke me up, but when it did, it scared the shit out of me. At first, I had no idea where I was. Then I picked up the phone. "You ready to go fishing?" my boss said. "It's 5:30. I'm on my way over." If it had been anyone else in the entire world but my boss, I would have told the guy to go fuck off and slept all day. But somewhere in the haze clogging my brain, I remembered the drunken promise I'd made the night before. I cleared my throat, got one eye all the way open, and hoped I sounded more tired than drunk. "Oh yeah, come on over," I said. "I overslept, but I'm ready." "All right, move your ass. I'll be there in 20 minutes. I got up, tried to see through my skull-splitting headache, and made it to the shower. I kind of stood there under the water for a few minutes. Then I threw on some sweatpants, brushed my teeth, and took a look in the mirror. It wasn't good at all. I looked like George Clinton when he got busted for crack. The shower hadn't come close to washing away the reek of liquor, and I had the worst bedhead I'd ever seen on someone who wasn't homeless. For a minute, I wondered if shaving might improve things. "Fuck it," I said, and I walked downstairs. Now, because my mother is both a crazy person and an insanely clean Italian woman, she was already up at 5:30 a.m. on Saturday vacuuming. As a working woman, my mother never got the chance to vacuum during the week and always had a full schedule of things to get done over the weekend, so she would get up at the crack of dawn on Saturday mornings and start cleaning. It was another reason that I liked to get passed out drunk on Friday nights, so I could sleep through the noise. I snuck downstairs knowing full well that there was no way I was going to make it out of the house on her watch. She had her back to me as I came down the stairs, but she seemed to sense me coming. It wasn't any kind of mother's intuition. Given my condition, it was probably just her sense of smell. She's one of those weird people who hate the smell of tequila, sweat, and stale orange juice. She took one look at me, death warmed over, stopped the vacuum, and stared me down for like a full minute. "Where are you going?" she asked. She looked at me with the utmost suspicion, like I was an intruder in her home. She probably thought I was sneaking out to buy drugs. "I'm going fishing, Ma," I said. "What?" she said, crossing her arms. "What are you doing?" "I'm going fishing, Ma. I got invited by my foreman at the job." "No, you are not, Artie," she said, now glaring at me. "You are not going fishing." "What do you mean I'm not going fishing?" I said. "I got invited fishing. I'm going fishing." I'd like to remind you that I was 23 years old, and until this point, not only had I never gone fishing, I'd never even shown an interest in anything that could be considered a hobby besides playing baseball, busting chops, drinking, and doing drugs. "Artie, you are not going fishing." Panic was creeping into her voice. At the time, I was somewhat heavy, definitely heavier than I was in high school, but svelte compared to how I am now. Still, to my mother, I was much too heavy and out of shape to do anything physical. Fishing isn't exactly running a 5K, but the water, in her mind, spelled certain death for her son. I could see her wheels spinning, thinking of what she could say to keep me from going. "You listen to me, Artie," she said, working herself into a yell that could strip paint from the walls. "You are not going fishing. You are not leaving this house. You are too fat to fish. Do you hear me? You are too fat to fish." Something clicked in my mind. Maybe it was just seeing me looking like that much of a mess, wondering what the hell I was doing to myself at night. Or maybe it was a fear of losing me after losing my father. Whatever it was to her in that moment, allowing me to go fishing was like allowing me to walk off a cliff. "Ma, it's my boss. I've got to go." I tried to reason with her. "He's going to be here in like 5 minutes. I got to get in good with this guy." "I don't give a shit, Artie. You can't swim. You don't like water. You are too fat to fish. I have never seen you do a thing. You have no interest. You have no hobbies. You aren't interested in anything but fooling around. You are not leaving this house. You will drown and die. You are too fat to fish." "Ma, I can swim." "No, you can't." "Ma, you see me swim," I yelled. "I swim every year in the ocean down at the shore." "I don't care, Artie. You are fat. You will die." She kept on like that for half an hour straight, and I couldn't get a word in edgewise. "You are going to fall out of that boat, and you will drown. Is there even a motor on this boat?" "I don't know, Ma." "You don't know? And you plan on going fishing on that boat? You don't even know how to fish. Tell me, what are you going to catch, Artie?" "I don't know, Ma. Tuna and bluefish?" "No, you won't. You will catch nothing. Because you're not going. Because you're too fat to fish." Whatever other points my mother made about why my plan was so outrageous, she kept returning to the fact that I was too fat to fish. It was like the chorus to an insane song she was singing. She got so worked up and loud that my sister, Stacy, woke up and lay in her bed hysterically laughing. She got so loud that my next-door neighbors woke up and started laughing because all of our windows were open. She just kept screaming the phrase, "too fat to fish." This was a battle that I was not going to win, so I called my foreman and luckily caught him right before he left his house. "Hey, man," I said. "I'm leaving now. What's up?" "Well, I can't go," I said. "This is real embarrassing, but my mother will not let me go fishing with you today." "Come on, fuck you," he started laughing. "That's a good one. I'll be right over." "No, I'm serious, man. She won't let me go." "What are you, 5 years old? You need a note from your ma, Artie?" "Come on, man. You're Italian. You know how Italian mothers can get." He got quiet for a minute. "She's really not letting you go?" When I put it that way, the guy understood what I was saying, but for good measure, I put my mother on the phone. "Artie is not going fishing today. He's not going anywhere on a boat with you because he's too fat to fish and will fall out of the boat. But go have a nice time." Luckily, my mother wasn't the type to embarrass me. I went upstairs, my hangover now infinitely worse after all that yelling, and ran into Stacy, who was about to piss herself laughing. "Do you realize that she screamed at you for like 40 minutes, she said, doubled over. "What the hell was that? People heard her down the block." "Yeah, I know." I passed out again in my clothes and slept until about 3 p.m., and when I woke up, my mother made me a mozzarella omelet, and I ate it, and I was never happier in my life. Then I went back to sleep. That night, over dinner, my sister started laughing again. "Ma, do you realize what you sounded like this morning?" Stacy asked. "I ran into the neighbors, and they heard the whole thing and were asking me about it. You just kept screaming that Artie is too fat to fish. Where did you come up with that?" "I don't know," my mother said, half smiling. "I just had to stop him any way I could." "But, Ma, do you realize what you sounded like?" It finally dawned on my mother, and when it did, she started laughing. Then I did too, and pretty soon all three of us were sitting there at the table, red-faced, not able to breathe over the fact that she not only made that up on the spot, but forced me to call my boss and tell him, as a 23-year-old man, that I could not go fishing. And then she told the guy herself that I was too fat to fish. The ball breaking started the minute I walked into work Monday, and it never stopped. Things at the port remained more or less the same until the Brazilian guy whose orange juice we were unloading got an idea in his head about cutting operating costs to increase his profit. The name we'll give this guy is Camacho, and he was paying his Brazilian workers like one fucking dollar a day to pick oranges for 15 hours. Then in Newark, he was paying us $19 an hour or $38 an hour with double time to fucking play Pinochle and 500 Rummy. He thought that if he could get scabs in there to break the union, he'd be making much more money, which of course he would be. In Camacho's eyes, he was ripping people off at one end and getting ripped off at the other end. In our eyes, we were doing a fucking dangerous job and we deserved that money, which was a wage we were proud of the union for getting us. Sure enough, in time, this guy at South America tried to break the union. One day we showed up for work and were locked out. Then about an hour after we were supposed to be at work, He brought in about 30 Portuguese men in armored buses with big grates over the windows and doors. They pulled right up and let these scabs out. We were told these guys were going to work for half our wage and that the operation was no longer a union shop. I feel privileged to have been there during this time because, let me tell you, longshoremen know how to fucking strike. We immediately picked up rocks, started throwing everything we could get our hands on at this fucking bus. The Portuguese guys were scared shitless, but the drivers got them in the gate and they locked us out. Someone in our crew put in a call to the powers that be while the rest of us continued to disrupt the work being done in every way that we could. This was the start of weeks of bitter striking. Every day we were out there picketing with signs, and guys were slashing tires and doing all kinds of shit. It was serious. One day this guy got pulled out of a truck, and the longshoreman just beat the crap out of him. I didn't really want to hurt anybody, and I didn't know what the fuck to do. I really wanted to make it as a comedian and didn't want to get arrested. So I kept my distance and threw things and watched the nutty shit the other guys did. These guys were fighting for their jobs. Who could blame them? It wasn't just a job. It was all they had. There were guys down there with not a lot of skills and families to support. There was nowhere else in the world they could land another gig like that. They were fighting for their livelihood. The union was great. They were very protective of our position and promised us that it would blow over. If it didn't work out, they said, we'd get work for equal pay elsewhere. At this point, I had about $6,000 saved in the bank. Enough was enough, and I thought it was my time to go. I was about to turn 24. I lived with my mother, so I didn't have to worry about rent, and I had $6,000. I decided that I'd get in my car every single night and go into the city to open mic and amateur comedy nights. I had thought about it nonstop for the past 2 years. How could I not, staring at the New York skyline from Port Newark every day? I think to myself, it's right fucking there. What are you doing here? I knew I'd be leaving a job that other people would kill for, that would take care of me for life, but I kept thinking that I wouldn't be able to live with myself if I pussied out and didn't try my best. That was it. I was going to start from scratch with no family or friends to give me advice about show business, and I was going to try to make it as a comedian. At the same time, I knew I was crazy for thinking of leaving. I'd been working for the union from February of 91 to September of 92, working on the docks with a real cast of characters. All I'd had to do was show up and mention my friend's father's name, and I was given a job. In 1991, I made about $60,000. If you had 700 hours in for the year, you qualified for what's called a container check, a truly amazing thing that the Longshoremen's Union does for its members. My buddy's father was instrumental in getting this thing going. He'd worked with the union and port management to clean the place up, and once he did, he went back to them with a plan to keep things that way. His point was that the port was busier than ever, that everybody was prospering, so he suggested that at Christmas time, each longshoreman be paid a penny or 2 cents for every container moved through the port in the year. Management agreed, so around Christmas in a busy year, a container check could be worth $4,000 or $5,000. In 91, it was like $4,500, of which I gave $2,000 to my mother as a Christmas present. I had not been able to help out much since my father's accident because I'd been so self-destructive. I had taken that union job specifically to be able to pay her back and help her out, and I was happy finally to be able to do that in some small way. It came at a good time, too, because my mother had a lot of expenses that year. We were still dealing with welfare and Medicaid, and it was all really depressing. My mother, to her complete credit, never once discouraged me from following my dream. I don't think a lot of mothers, if I were their son, would have done the same. As a matter of fact, she was upset that I was working at the port to help support her. As I've mentioned, she desperately tried to protect me and my sister financially and emotionally from my father's accident, which, of course, was completely impossible. My mother looked at my work down at the port, as well as some of the drug, drinking, and gambling problems I had, as a byproduct of my father's accident. I think she saw these things as her failure. But she was wrong. That shit is just in my personality, and I would have gone through that rebellious time no matter what. My mom didn't see it that way, and she felt guilty. So when I told her I wanted to take my savings and live off it for as long as I could while I pursued my dream, she was elated and supported it wholeheartedly. It would have been nearly impossible to get through all the rejections and hard times that lay ahead of me if my mother didn't believe in me. Before I could start chasing my dream, I had to take care of one last thing. I had to tell my buddy's father, the great man I'm indebted to for life, who'd gotten me the job, that I wanted to quit. I felt incredibly guilty. He had done me such a huge favor. I had to quit the proper, respectful way. I had to thank him and explain my reasons for leaving. I was scared shitless, because I knew he'd be mad. I ran through different ways that conversation would go down, with me attempting to explain why I needed to try my best to be a comedian, but there really wasn't any way I could make it sound like a reasonable decision. I waited outside his office for like 2 hours, which did nothing much for my nerves. I brought him a nice bottle of wine that I gave him, sat down, probably looking as nervous as I felt. "Thanks for the wine, Mike," he said. "So how have you been?" "Oh, fine, I'm doing all right." "Glad to hear it. So, Mike, what can I do for you?" For the entire meeting, the guy called me Mike, which had me on the verge of laughing the entire time. He'd gotten another friend of ours, one of the millions of Mikes, a job too, and he'd clearly gotten us confused, but I wasn't about to correct him. He was a nice enough guy, but he was one of those really impressive, really intimidating union guys. He was an incredible public speaker whenever I saw him at union events. From the moment he shook your hand, you could tell that he was not a guy to be fucked with. "Listen, sir," I said, "this has been the greatest couple of years of my life because I made all of this money and was able to help my mother out and save some money for myself for the first time in my life. I'm glad to have helped you out, Mike. I'm glad I could give you that opportunity." "Well, sir, I don't know if your son ever told you about this, but I'm an aspiring comedian," I said. "I really want to get into show business, and the only way I can do it properly is to quit right here and now and get a part-time job and go in and out of New York City whenever I can to auditions." He looked at me like I had three heads. "What?" he said. "I'm not sure I heard you just right. What are you going to do?" "I need to quit the job to be able to go to New York and make it in show business." "Listen to me, Mike," he said very seriously. "This is a great job. People kill for this job. You are not appreciating what you've been given." "I do appreciate it, sir. I really do," I said. "I wouldn't be able to even attempt to pursue this if it weren't for this job. I saved up enough money to give me some leeway until I get a part-time job while I try to make it." "And what are you going to do for the rest of your life?" he said. "Well, I'm going to try to make it in show business. I'm going to do whatever it takes." "I don't even know what to say to that, Mike," he said. "What are the odds of that happening? You're just going to waltz into New York City and make it?" Everything he said was right, and he wasn't insulted as much as he was concerned. After all, he had about 100 names ready to take my spot. "Mike, I want you to rethink this," he said. "Have you told your mother about this?" "Yes, sir." "And what did she say?" My mother was actually supportive of it. "You're a real good friend of my son, Mike, or else he wouldn't have asked me to help you out after your dad died," he said, looking at me very seriously. "Listen, I love you, and there's nothing I wouldn't do for you. That's why I'm going to be honest with you, since other people might not be. Listen to me. There's about a 50-million-to-1 shot that you're going to make it in show business. It's not easy. If it was, everyone would do it." "I know that," I said. "I'm ready for that. I'm going to give it my all. You know, in high school, I was kind of the class clown. I could get laughs and stuff." Around this guy, I was not, however. I was nothing but shy. "That's it? A class clown? You really need to rethink this. That's not going to cut it." This went on for a while longer until finally he gave up. He looked me in the eye, realized that I was serious, and that was it. "Well, listen, Mike, I cannot guarantee you anything, but when it doesn't work out, you come to us and we'll try to get you another job here." I always thought it was funny that he said when and not if. It wasn't malicious. He cared about me, that was all. But he didn't consider success a possibility for me. I will never forget him for extending that offer because he was completely serious and way more generous than he should have been with me. I wasn't family, but he treated me like his own. He took the time to talk to me like a father would to his own son. All the guys down at the port were the same way. About a year later, I went back there to say hello. I had lost a bunch of weight because I had started exercising, doing what I could to try to look good for headshots and auditions. The minute I walked in, I ran at the chick, the 60-year-old Italian speed chess master, who stopped what he was doing and stared at me. "What's the matter?" he said. "You sick? You're so thin." He probably thought I'd gotten AIDS from going on auditions. "I'm not sick, chick. I landed a role," I said. "I'm playing a starving actor now." He looked at me dead serious and pointed his finger in my direction. "You listen to me," he said. "You come down here, you will always get a meal. You hear me? We will always feed you." As it happened, I didn't starve, and I didn't have to get another job before landing a paying gig in show business. It wasn't much at all, but I got a job right out of the fucking box in a dinner theater play. A friend told me about the audition, and I got it. It was a paid acting job, so I couldn't complain at all. The play was a murder mystery that was set in a catering hall, and I played a drunk priest with a southern accent who actually turned out to be the murderer, which I thought was kind of cool. And for obvious reasons, since there was booze on the premises, it was great to have to play a drunk. It allowed me to be method about it. For the first 3 months of 92, we toured restaurants and catering halls in North, Central, and South Jersey. We'd perform a five-act show, and between acts, we served the audience their courses of food in character. That was cool because I'd have to improv with these people as a southern priest while serving them a salad. We got $40 a show, and since we were the waiters too, we kept the tips. On a good night, you could easily make an extra $100 that went right into your pocket. One of my fellow actors in that production was this kid, Jimmy Palumbo, who I'm still friends with today. Those of you who have seen Beer League will know him as Johnny Trino, the shortstop. We really got tight doing dinner theater. After 3 months, it was like we'd known each other all our lives. So when that run ended, Jimmy and I figured we'd try to make it in New York together, since it was better than going it alone. For the next 3.5 years, we'd take the bus or Jimmy's shitty Honda or my shitty Chevy Citation into the city, chasing our dreams. I did stand-up wherever I could. Jimmy and I both wrote and did sketch comedy, and eventually we got an improv group together that we called Live on Tape. This kid Mike Stafford was in it with us and produced it. And we did off-Broadway shows in a theater down on West 18th Street. Our show was a review of sketches and pre-taped bits of material. We'd do 2 live sketches. Then, while we changed costumes instead of for the next 2, we showed a tape sketch on a big screen so we didn't lose the audience, hence the name. Those shows did well enough that we got to do gigs at Caroline's, the famous comedy club. They let us do a bring-your-own show, which meant that they gave us the place from 7 to 8 p.m. before the real show started for the evening, and we had to sell our own tickets. 4 separate times we'd sold the place out. We did improv and sketches, and I did stand-up after. Those shows were really exciting. We invited friends down, and we always killed. The 4th time, a guy from the William Morris Agency that Mike Stafford had met at a wedding came down, and not because he was really impressed with Mike or anything, but because we'd bombarded his office with flyers. I have a feeling that if Caroline's had been more than 2 blocks away from William Morris, we'd have never seen this guy. But the show that night was great, and that's how we met a commercial agent named Peter Principato, who ended up signing 5 of us. Jimmy and I were among the 5 that agency took on, and they started sending us out on auditions for commercials, which was a big, big step for us. Peter and I had a great working relationship for a while. He was my agent when I got Mad TV, and after he left the agency to become a manager, I went with him. He became my manager for 10 years, and even though we had a falling out, I still love the guy. I really miss Pete in a lot of ways, but our relationship became dysfunctional and had to end. It's too bad because Pete stuck with me through everything. When I got arrested while on Mad TV, which you will soon hear about, he flew to Los Angeles the minute he heard about it and waited with my sister for hours at the LA County Jail. I couldn't believe he did that. He just left his desk at William Morris without a care for his job or his other clients and flew out to LA. I feel terrible about how it ended with Pete. The truth is, years later, it seemed like he wasn't doing much work for me after he'd moved to the West Coast. I guess it was too hard for him to be so far away and stay focused on my career. In any case, I didn't handle it how I should have. I said some shit about him on the air after I'd been on the show for a couple of years, and he wrote me a letter saying that maybe we shouldn't work together anymore. I responded by calling him and blowing my stack, and that's how we ended our relationship. I had my lawyer write a termination letter, and that was it. I wish Pete nothing but the best because he was there from the beginning, and he really stuck by me. I blame myself for the unpleasantness. It's one of the things I really wanted to make clear in this book. I am sorry that I'm not with Pete anymore, and I wish him the best. He's got a very successful management company in Beverly Hills now, so he's doing fine, but he was the guy who believed in me back in 1993, and he stuck by me, and I miss him. Show business is very bittersweet that way. Always was and always will be. You meet so many people and you grow so close to some of them, for a while you're working together toward a goal. Then some bullshit happens and you're enemies, or you end up not talking because there's some kind of weirdness between you, and it really sucks. In so many ways, show business really sucks. Being on a stage or being on the radio or on TV or acting in a film is great. That's the high. That's the fun. That's what you do it for. But just about everything else, the business of it, most of all, is really fucked up, sad, and depressing. And that's when you're successful. When you're not, there's a whole other level of hell piled on top. Luckily for me, it was only 3.5 years between the day I quit working at Port Newark and the day I got cast on Mad TV. 3.5 years of struggling and being broke isn't bad at all, and I feel very thankful for that. I was only 27 when I got my big break and ended up on a network show where I made good money, and I've never looked back. Unfortunately, there's always a downside to all of my upsides. During those 3.5 years, I developed a terrible cocaine problem that I took on my back with me out to LA. It ended up costing me my job and a lot more before I got it under control. During my struggling years, the too fat to fish story became legendary. The phrase was emblazoned in our memory from the day my mom first screamed it loud enough to wake the neighborhood. We laughed about that story at every holiday meal. It never got old. Even though I am the punchline in the story, I loved it when my mother or sister brought it up because sharing laughter with them, cracking each other up around the dinner table, made me feel the way our family felt when my pop was still with us. I had to commemorate that story somehow because as time went on, too fat to fish became my mantra. I knew the outlet when I saw it. After my 2 years on Mad TV, where I was making close to 200 grand a year, I got a development deal from Fox that paid me 750 grand, so I was doing very well. I had enough money to start a corporation, so my Uncle Tom, who is a financial planner, told me to take my first $250,000 development check and incorporate myself. I remember holding that check, showing it to my mother, and wondering how many roofs my old man would have had to climb to make that kind of money. We decided it would have been about $500,000. Those were good times. I was able all at once to bail my mother out of every single financial debt she had. I was also finally able to do what I'd always wanted to do for her, buy her a house, a car, furniture, and anything else she wanted. I was finally able to be the man of the house for her like I'd always wanted. Money isn't everything, but it sure helps when you have it. And since I've had it, my mother has been a lot less stressed, and I'm very proud of that. Anyway, I named my company Too Fat to Fish. I went to the bank, opened the account with that check, registered it all through a lawyer, and told my mother nothing. I did get my mother her own account in the corporation, though with an official book of checks that had her name on it, at Too Fat to Fish Incorporated. When she saw it, she burst out laughing. "What did you do?" she said. "Why did you name your corporation that?" "You named it, Ma." The truth is, Too Fat to Fish is more than just a story to me. It represents all those times that I felt like a complete loser or was told I couldn't do something. But now that I've made something of myself on my own terms, the phrase is even funnier to me. It's a justification and an inside joke and a tribute to the mother who believed in me, except when it came to fishing, all at the same time. The only thing that matters is that I'm not too fat for comedy. And let's face it, can anyone ever be too fat for comedy?
Hi, I'm the Reverend Bob Levy, and I'm reading for Artie's audio book of his book. Book. Because Gary the retard couldn't fly from Portland. Driving Miss Wasted. In 1992, I willingly left a job working as a longshoreman in the port of Newark and officially entered what I call the struggling years. My only regular form of employment at this point was driving a cab. It wasn't all bad. Of the many ways I've wasted time, both mine and other people's, for money, driving a cab was absolutely the best job I ever had. It was pretty enjoyable as far as struggling for a very meager living part-time jobs go. It was fun. And I have to be honest here, there were so many fucking losers working that job, the fact that I had an IQ over 80 made me the company's most valuable player. Competition was not tough among a group of guys who were barely able to spell their names as an X on their employment forms. Most people didn't carry cell phones in 1992, which in this particular field of employment really worked to my advantage. I spent most of my days making runs from Union Township to JFK Airport, a trip that involved crossing from our dispatcher's area into a huge Bermuda Triangle along the Belt Parkway where the company CB was out of range. I think it took me exactly 2 days to figure out precisely where we drivers entered the great unknown. It was the moment you hit Randazzo's Clam Bar in Sheepshead Bay. You passed Randazzo's out there on the belt, and then you were off the map, completely incommunicado. Randazzo's was a beacon of freedom on the horizon. I knew Randazzo's from their classic low-budget commercials that ran during local Yankee television broadcasts. Their ads featured a guy fanning his mouth in the worst acting job ever captured on film, saying, "That Randazzo's hot sauce. Oh boy, is that hot." Usually, I'd celebrate the fact that my boss could no longer track me for a while by stopping at Randazzo's for a meal on my way to or from JFK. I spent all of my tips on calamari and cheesecake, which made me think that cab driving was my kind of job. If you think I'm bullshitting, hear this. I once got my driver's license suspended for DUI, and the next day, when I dragged my ass into the office and told the owner of the company that I had to quit because I was no longer legally able to drive anymore anywhere, he looked at me and as seriously as he could said, "Well, you know what? I won't tell anyone about it if you want to keep driving." I've never been what anyone would call a strict observer of rules, so I was more than willing to stay on. The truth is I owe my life now to that guy and that dead-end job and that crap reception of that crap CB system. Because if all those other factors weren't in place, I'd never have been able to drive myself into Manhattan while on the job for stand-up sets every night. each of those early open mic experiences, as ugly as they were at the time, boosted me up. I didn't know why. And got me one step closer to where I am now. If that shitty cab company wasn't so fucked up, run by that loosest fuck system they had going, I'd never have developed as a comic. Because it wasn't going to happen anywhere but in the clubs of Manhattan. This cab job was the kind of gig where the hours were so unbelievably flexible that I could pull off an insane degree of bullshit. I was actually able to become a regular at the comic strip on the Upper East Side without losing my job. I got a 20-minute set on any given night between Tuesday and Saturday. If I had a set from 9:30 to 9:50 at night, my dispatcher would let me drive the cab from 3 to 8:30. He would be cool with me taking the car into New York, where I would double park in front of the comic strip, and I'd get one of my comic friends to watch it while I went in to do a 20-minute routine. Then I'd run back out, get in my cab, and drive back to New Jersey. As soon as I got through the Holland Tunnel, I'd call my dispatcher and say, "Hey, I'm back on." And then I'd work from 1 to 2 a.m. and make another $200 for the night. I'll say it again, it was the perfect gig for a guy doing his best to make it in show business via comedy. It also left me free to do auditions during the day for commercials. I drove the cab to get those too. The job was all cash too, so, you know, a cash gig never hurts either. Now that we're talking about cab driving, I realized for a very short, completely misled minute, I made the mistake of thinking that taking a job waiting tables might be a better career move. It's true, I thought being a waiter was a step up in showbiz. So for a millisecond, I was basically a walking cliché. I was a guy who wanted to make it, who would also never be a good waiter. On every level, this short-lived endeavor had to go. And it did, in a matter that was swift, decisive, and awful. My sister got me my one and only waiter job at a Mexican restaurant in Hoboken, right across the street from the PAT train. It was an easy gig, lunch 3 days a week, with an arrival time of 10:30 a.m. As I recall, my first day waitering went off without a hitch, though I really didn't like it at all. My second day was different. The night before, I went out drinking at a bar called the Rusty Scupper with my buddy Danny McGrath, who was a cop. I got ossified drunk, and for a reason I no longer recall, I got into a fist fight. I swung at a bouncer, and in response to my aggression, he took me by both sides of my hair and gave me what is commonly known among dickheads who get into fights in bars as the stop sign. You take somebody by both sides of the head and introduce their nose to your kneecap. That's what happened to me. My nose exploded. By the time the cops showed up, I was a mess and still drunk and ready to tussle. The officers were ready to arrest me, even though I hadn't done much more than get my nose rearranged. Luckily, my buddy Danny flashed his badge, after which his peers said to him, "Just get him the fuck out of here." Danny then drove me to Union Hospital, around the corner from where I grew up, and he waited with me for 3 hours while they patched up my nose. I was blacked out at this point. When my sister called early the next morning, I was already late for the lunch shift. I remember realizing two things after I told her I'd be there as soon as I could. I knew I was going to quit, and I also knew that my face looked like hamburger, and I had two black eyes. I didn't want to embarrass my sister either. But what I still don't understand is how I figured that showing up in the condition I was in would be less of an embarrassment than not showing up at all. So I got dressed and ran into the lunch rush at the restaurant. The manager just stared at me the moment I crossed the doorway. He didn't say anything, and he didn't get in my way, so I went about doing lunch. The first couple I served were two yuppies who could have been the cover of Yuppie magazine. Khaki shorts, polo shirts, and a BMW parked outside. I went up to them, took their drink order, and quickly returned with their drinks. I cleared my throat and said, "Do you want to hear the specials?" The woman said yes, and looked up at me as I began reciting them. I was in a trance, kind of wondering how was I even doing this at all, when I saw a look of horror come over her face. She started screaming, seriously screaming, and I had no idea why. What? What? I said. She looked like she'd just seen someone beheaded. She shrieked, "Your nose is bleeding." Sure enough, she was right. It was bleeding pretty good. Flowing all over my shirt, nice and red. The sight of it had this woman in complete panic. She was so out of her mind that the manager came running over before I could do anything about it. The manager was an intimidating, middle-aged Italian-American gentleman who hadn't, it seemed, gotten the memo informing everyone that carbs cause weight gain. He appeared at my side and dragged me into the back of the house and bitch-slapped me. He really got into it, too. I remember him pushing me up against a wall and getting in my face and hissing at me, "Get the fuck out of here! I never want to see you again!" He also accused me of getting into a bar fight and getting coked up right before. He had that completely wrong. I got coked before the bar fight. I didn't care about being roughhouse like that. I was fucking pissed off that I'd been fired before I could quit. Let me get back to the point here, which has to do with the worst experience I ever had at the best worst job I ever had. So I went back to the cab company after my brief interlude as a waiter. And this one night I drove the cab from like 10 a.m. to 3 a.m., which was the longest shift I would ever work. On top of that, I had the Knicks getting 5 from the Bulls that night. So I was watching the game at the dispatch station. The Knicks lost to the Bulls, of course. Fuck you, Michael Jordan. At 2:45 a.m., we got a call to pick up these two twits. It was a quiet night, but I was never what you might call ambitious at this job. So I still don't know why I agreed to take that last call. If there's one thing I learned driving cabs, and I learned it that night too, is this. That one last call is always the strangest you will ever get. Whatever. Then I didn't know. I took it on. I went out there. It was a pickup at a Holiday Inn in Kenilworth, New Jersey. A couple coming from a wedding. They needed to be taken to Route 22 West in Dunellen, which is about a half-hour drive. We all knew around the dispatch office that any wedding at a Holiday Inn at Kenilworth meant somebody was ringing the white trash bell loudly. So I got to the Holiday Inn, and the couple drunkenly spills into the back of the cab. I got their address, and the good news was that I kind of knew where that street was, so I would not have to bug them again. Or so I thought. They were, as far as I could tell, a kid probably in a suit for the first time and his chick, a blonde in a black mini dress, really hot. I'd say she was a 9 or a 10. And both of them were in their mid-20s, but they were going on 57. As they came into my cab, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I wanted to freeze frame it. Being very drunk is fine, but what I couldn't understand is why they were behaving like horrible, old, extremely unhappy people. Not your run-of-the-mill unhappy people next door. They were unhappy, like the people who live in trailers on cops. From the outside, they had no reason to fight, but when they got into the cab, they were about to start hurting each other. I turned up the radio and listened to Allison Steele, the Nightbird. Coming to me on 92.3 K-Rock, I focused on driving, thanking the stars above, that I actually knew where we were going. About 5 minutes later, as we wound up on Route 22, I started to hear some serious clenched teeth arguing going on in the back seat. It was fight night for these two, and it was on. Every other sentence was like, "Fuck you, motherfucker! No, fuck that! Fuck you!" I took a look in my rearview mirror and saw both of them red in the face, just really going at each other. Each of them just inches away from each other. Both flat out yelling. I turned the radio up a little louder and thought to myself, fuck it. 5 minutes later, I heard slap. Just a real solid slap, skin on skin. I hesitated again. Then looked into the rearview mirror and saw my ears weren't lying. He fucking smacked her. Her lip was bleeding a little bit. And to make matters worse, he had one arm around his shoulders, holding her. And with the other hand, he was strangling her. I actually couldn't believe what the fuck I was seeing. At this point, I thought what any decent man would. I figured, like my girlfriend, this bitch must have a listening problem. Just kidding. At this time, I didn't even have a girlfriend. I pulled the car right over, leaned across the back of the cab, and grabbed the guy. He turned away from her and looked at me like I was the enemy. I said to him, dude, what are you doing? You are fucking killing this girl. If you keep this shit up, I'm throwing you out of the cab, I'm taking her home, and I'm calling the cops. I thought this was the obvious right thing to do, but I began to doubt myself as the girl looked at me blankly with a pair of drunken saucer eyes. She didn't seem to mind what was going on, and when the guy looked at me, I realized that I actually ruined some kind of moment for them. I never forgot what the guy said to me, because it was funny in a way that was so primal that there was no way at all that he could have possibly premeditated it. All right, man, he said. Then he put up his hands and waved me away. All right, then, just drive, hero. Hero? Hero? I started driving again. I put the radio up while I worried that this guy was going right back to killing her. A few minutes went by, and I realized that it's been dead silent in the cab for some time. Fearing the worst, I took a look in the rearview mirror and saw that it's been silenced because these two idiots were making out in a crazy, sexy way. He had her skirt up over her top, and he was grabbing her ass. They were about 2 seconds from fucking. They went from the angry couple you see on Cops to the couple you see on Cops who got arrested for fucking in public. Clearly, their problem had resolved itself. So I returned to listening to music. That didn't last long. A minute or so later, I found myself distracted, wondering whether I'd rather clean up her blood or his jizz at the end of the night. And I gotta tell you, man, it wasn't looking too good for her as the debate went on in my head. But at this point, something far more serious took over. I started to realize I had a burning case of the shits coming on. I have never eaten well, and because of that, this shit thing happens to me every once in a while. I don't know if it was simply that, or if it was the sudden stress, but I can tell you this. It was fucking happening, all right. There was no doubt about it. These were the kind of shits where there was nothing to be done. These shits were coming. In a matter of minutes. No matter what. And they didn't care if my pants were on or not. I looked up just then, and thank God my passenger's exit was up ahead. Because as I turned down the ramp, I was a mile from their house and about a minute away from leaking all over my cab. The situation was no joke. They were making out like nobody's business, and I was about to shit all over the front seat. And these two formerly fighting, now making out fuckers, were totally oblivious. They were sticking their tongues down each other's throat as I spread my legs and tried to hold my ass closed. All while driving a car with the gas pedal pinned to the floor. I blasted through red light after red light, looking for their address. It looked like I was gonna make it until I realized as I approached their house that I had to ask the guy in the back if I can use his bathroom. I figured it's been about 20 minutes tops since I almost punched him out and threatened him with police intervention. As I pulled into their driveway, about 80 miles an hour, I faced the fact that I had a pretty shitty chance at winning them over and not much time to do it. We came to a screeching halt, and they were thrown all over the back seat. They stumbled out laughing and fell over each other on their way up the walk to the front door. I followed them, not only because they haven't paid me yet. Dude, I said, trying to be at least a little bit cool, I gotta use your bathroom. All right, he said. Then his girl looked at me crooked. You cannot use our bathroom, she said. What? I asked, why? You're a stranger, she said. We don't know you. Who are you? We are not just going to let you in the house. I looked at this girl, the same girl I tried to keep from being beat up by the guy swaying next to her. The guy looked at her, too. Even he thought it was bullshit. Honestly, at this point, I wanted to hit her if this shithead wasn't going to do it again. Dude, man, I'm sorry, he said all slurry. She's a real cunt. She just fucking gets this way. It was beyond the point of no return for me. So when the guy handed me a bill, I grabbed it without looking. I ran to the car as fast as I could without letting it all go, because my bowels were liquefying. I mean, second by second as I was standing there. I drove to the nearest place I can find, a 7-Eleven. I ran in, probably looking like I was about to hold up the place. I grabbed the guy behind the counter by the shirt, and I demanded a bathroom key. He could tell that I wasn't fucking around because I was so visibly uncomfortable and about to shit all over the room. No one in their right mind was going to keep me from doing what was obviously going to happen anyway. Mr. Clerk did the sensible thing and allowed me to let it happen in the right place. And finally, for the first time in what seemed like an eternity, I enjoyed some fucking relief. And that's when I realized that I was still holding the bill the guy from the cab had given me. That's also when I realized it was a 20 when it should have been a 50, which was the cost of the ride without the tip. So this little joyride from hell cost me $30, which came out of my money at the end of the night, as well as whatever tip I would have hypothetically gotten. At this moment, I felt a few things. I was relieved that my bowels had loosened themselves above a toilet, when just a few minutes before, I resigned myself to the worst-case scenario. I was also, after a moment's reflection, almost fine with the fact that I've lost $30 to the negligence of those two model citizens. But what I really had a problem with, and the more I thought about it, the more I couldn't let it go, was the lack of tip. As far as I could tell, shits and speeding aside, I thought my service was impeccable.